Hey, we'll call the Senate Human Services and Rural Health Policy Committee to order, please. Welcome on this beautiful, sunny Monday morning. No rains, no snow, sleet, hail.
Ice.
Okay, and no fireworks, so just cool your jets. Okay, we're going to open a public hearing this morning on Senate Bill 154. Would you like to give us a brief rundown on that, please?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 154 repeals the Senior Prescription Drug Assistant Program, which was established in the Department of Human Services in 2001.
Okay. Sandy, would you like to come up?
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Sandy Wood. I'm the Legislative Coordinator for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to ask for your support of Senate Bill 154 that eliminates the Senior Prescription Drug Assistance Program. Your support of this bill also supports the Department's Transformation Initiative. The senior drug program requires the department to provide a drug discount card to seniors below 185% of the federal poverty level so they can buy their drugs at the Medicaid price. It costs seniors $50 to enroll in the program, which is the only funding for the program, and there are no federal matching funds available. We estimated in 2001 that we'd have about 100,000 seniors who were eligible for this program, but in its heyday, the senior drug program never exceeded 300 clients. Right now, we have 3 clients in the program. The seniors tell me that they can buy their drugs cheaper than the Medicaid price by going to large pharmacies that provide discounts to cash-paying customers, which I think is the reason the program's never been effective. Because the program is mandatory in the statutes, we are required to continue the program and keep the infrastructure going, even if we had no clients in the program. Better options now exist for our clients. Medicare Part D and the Oregon Prescription Drug Assistance Program provide better benefits. Yet this is an alluring program to seniors, and it's confusing for them, but it makes false promises. Continuing this ineffective program is wasteful government, and it's not how we want to treat seniors in Oregon. I ask for your support of Senate Bill 154. That concludes my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Good. Thank you, Sandy. Questions?
Questions? No. Okay.
Yes. I have one question.
Yeah.
I think you told me when you came to talk to me, but would you put on record what will happen to those 3 clients that are on the program right now?
Yes, I will. Well, if the bill passes and the clients are still on the program on January 1 when the bill would take effect, we're going to transition them to the Oregon Prescription Drug Program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sandy.
Okay.
Okay, with that, see no others wishing to testify. Pardon me?
Did you get the roll call sheet?
No. Well, any others wishing to testify? Now, Sandy, would you come back up, please?
We don't have a fiscal yet, do
well,
we?
I know. we're not supposed to move a bill until we have a fiscal and a revenue impact. We have no revenue impact. Would you say there was any fiscal impact?
There's no fiscal impact of this bill. We don't have any staff dedicated to the program. We only have the 3 clients, so that adds up to, you know, that they paid $150 to join the program. And I would imagine, actually, those 3 clients will probably not renew when the time comes, but there isn't any fiscal there.
Okay.
It doesn't bring in any money, and it's really not costing us anything.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks, Anne.
Is that it?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, if we passed it and then...
fiscal showed up, we could always bring it back up.
We could bring it back.
Yeah.
Or what are your instructions?
We can carry the bill over until we receive the fiscal. I requested it and asked for it to be here by today, but
yeah.
Unfortunately, we didn't receive it so that we could move it out of the committee if it was that was
well,
desire.
We can carry
so,
it over.
But we can carry it over.
Okay.
Keep carrying it over.
Okay.
Thank you.
Public hearing is closed on Senate Bill 154, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 287. And Mary, here, Jim Carlson, Bob Junebat. Okay. You get to speak for all three, I guess. Jim Carlson. Bob Junebat.
Make our lives easier.
Well, would you both like to come up, please, and you can figure things out as we go along. Mary?
Chair Morissette, with the committee's and the chair's permission, I would defer to Mr. Junebat to go first on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Junebat. I'm the executive director of Disability Rights Oregon. Disability Rights Oregon used to be called Oregon Advocacy Center, and we changed our name, but we haven't changed anything else. So it's a rebranding exercise, they tell me.
We do that here all the time, Bob. So.
Senate Bill 287 is a product of our office, and here's the problem that it seeks to address. One of the things that our organization does is respond to complaints of abuse or neglect in residential facilities. The two areas where we spend the most of our time are in facilities for people with developmental disabilities and also folks with mental illness. As you might expect, over the years, we have been presented with conditions in group homes that are problematic. And I'm not here to name names, but I can tell you that we have seen situations that are very troubling and that have escaped the notice either of the local county or DHS. In those situations where we have found problems, we brought them to the attention of the appropriate agencies, and the agencies have responded. What we've learned in that process is that when there is a home which is, in our estimation, extremely problematic, DHS has the authority to look at that particular home. But in cases in which an operator operates multiple homes, DHS cannot take action against the operator of multiple homes regarding the multiple homes. So they license individual homes, but they don't license the operator per se. So what we've been told is that DHS will respond to complaints that we bring to them for that individual home, but when we have asked DHS to look at other homes that particular operator owns and operates, DHS says that they cannot ask the operator to make changes or guarantee that there will be compliance in multiple homes. They can only address the problem in that single home. And as you might expect, the time, energy, and resources that are necessary to go across the board to then other homes operated by that same owner is very demanding. It's demanding, I'm sure, for DHS, certainly for an organization of our kind, to bring individual complaints to them. So what this bill would do, this bill does not require DHS to do anything. What it does is it gives DHS the authority to require that corrections be made in multiple homes owned by an owner when DHS has concerns about a particular home operated by that individual. In other words, it's giving DHS more flexibility to require compliance with DHS rules for an operator, which we feel is more efficient and can lead to greater safety and quality conditions for the people who are living in the homes. I hope that that is clear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are multiple homes the rule or the exception?
In our understanding, there's a large percentage of homes of owners who operate more than one home, but I would defer to DHS to give you the actual figures on that.
Okay. Thank you. Questions of Bob? Okay. Thank you, Bob. Mary.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Mary Geer. I'm the administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care in Seniors and People with Disabilities Division, Department of Human Services. I've submitted written testimony that has some background in it. Just briefly, I'll bring up the major points of that. I would first want to point out that this bill is targeted to residential care facilities. And by statute, that defines or encompasses 24-hour residential facilities that serve people with developmental disabilities, residential facilities that serve people who have mental health and addictions issues, and also seniors and people with physical disabilities. So it covers a wide range of facilities, including assisted living facilities. Currently, as Mr. Jundeff said, the department has the authority to look at one license at a time. And so if there is an agency, for example, that has multiple licensed facilities, if there is one facility or two facilities that are having difficulty, that are out of compliance, where we might be looking at a non-renewal or a revocation of a license, we've been asked on occasion to revoke or look at revocation of all the licenses that licensee might have, and currently we don't have the authority to do so. So if we have concerns about how a particular agency is running their multiple license facilities, we would need to take license revocation action one at a time based on the compliance history of that particular facility, not all of the facilities as a whole. In addition, this bill also proposes adding criteria for looking at initial licensure that would allow a licensor to look at the current and past compliance history of a licensee who might be running other facilities when the department or the licensor would look at licensing them for yet another site, another licensed facility, residential facility. So this bill really increases the authority of the department at both ends, at the initial licensure and at the revocation or termination stage at the other end. There are several comments that we would offer to the bill. One is that it's very specific to indicate that it's a person, the licensee is a person, and we would assume that this is much broader to include any agency or corporation or type of organization, but just wanted to point out that that language was specific in the bill. We also noted that the bill gives the department the authority to look at license compliance with other residential facilities, so that would be 24-hour residential, assisted living, residential care facilities. We do have agencies and corporations who hold licenses for other kinds of facilities. On the senior and physical disability side of things, there might be an agency or organization that runs nursing homes, assisted living, might run foster homes. And the same thing may be true with an agency that runs a program for people with developmental disabilities. They may run 24-hour residential, employment services, foster homes, those kinds of things. And so just simply wanted to point out that as a potential issue with the bill. And finally, the bill proposes that the department look at compliance, and we would simply offer that there is a term of art called substantial compliance. There's always difficulty defining what compliance means, and would ask the committee to potentially consider that. The last thing I would point out is that in reviewing this bill, the Division of Addictions and Mental Health and Seniors and People with Disabilities estimated that there would be a fiscal impact, in that we would anticipate, we would anticipate an increase in contested case hearings for initial licenses and revocations, and so would assume that there would be an increase in Department of Justice costs of about $240,000 per bite. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I want to follow up with what Senator Morissette was asking. How many facilities are we talking about here? Are operators and actually corporations, too?
Chair Morissette, Senator Mona Sanderson, thank you for the reminder to address that issue. On the developmental disabilities side of things, I'm not going to have specific numbers to share with you. I don't have them on the top of my head, but we would be happy to get those for you. My sense would be on the DD side that we're probably looking at most facilities are operated by an agency with multiple licenses. For seniors and people with physical disabilities, there are a number of corporations that probably operate a majority of our residential care and assisted living facilities, but I would need to look at the numbers to get a good breakdown of that.
Can you follow up?
Yes.
And how many in the state? Hundreds? Thousands?
Hundreds.
Hundreds.
Excuse me, Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Sanderson. There are approximately 1,700 adult foster homes that serve seniors and people with physical disabilities. There are another 100 foster homes that serve people with addiction and mental health issues. There are 500 foster homes that serve people with developmental disabilities. There are 130 nursing facilities. There are approximately 500 residential care and assisted living facilities. And on the DD side with residential care, supported living, employment programs, I would need to look up the numbers on those, but would be happy to provide them.
I'm sorry, did you... I started writing them down, then I kind of got lost. Mm-hmm. Adult foster homes? Did you discuss adult foster homes?
Chair Morissette, this bill does not address foster homes. And one of the comments that I'd made is that particularly in DD services, there are providers who operate both residential care and foster homes.
That would be... interesting. I'd like to have that data that you discussed.
Chair Morissette, I'd be happy to.
In terms of the numbers, and Jim, maybe you could supplement that as well. Mary, is this a problem? Is this what this bill addresses, a problem for DHS? Okay, let me rephrase that. What's the magnitude of the problem?
Senator Morissette, for agencies that provide developmental disability services, I'm going back the last couple years in my mind, and we've had two or three situations where we've had concerns about an agency as a whole and have taken action one license at a time to either downsize or encourage that agency to move on. For services to seniors and people with physical disabilities, it gets a little bit more complicated, and I'm sure Mr. Carlson will speak to that. When we have a corporation that's operating a number of facilities, it's very typical to see that there are some facilities doing quite well and some facilities that are not doing well at all. As Mr. Jundeff said, it would give the department the authority to deal with multiple license issues, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the department would choose to, when an operator might be doing just fine in some situations.
Okay, that's interesting. Why do we have a fiscal let me rephrase that. If you chose not to do anything, there would not be a fiscal. The fiscal would come into play, assuming that you would do something, I imagine that's probably what we would be.
Chair Morissette, that's exactly right. And again, this bill gives the department the authority to deny initial licenses where the licensee would have a contested case.
Okay.
And then also to revoke licenses where there is certainly a contested case.
Okay.
Option.
Now, would that be an additional cost?
Senator Morissette, for each time the department has a contested case hearing, we use the services of the Department of Justice to represent us, and that's the cost.
But you're already doing that.
Senator Morissette, Chair Morissette, we are already doing contested case hearings. We are estimating that if this bill were to be in effect and we took action in response to this bill, there would be an increase in the request for contested case hearings because there would be a possibility that we would have more license denials and more revocations.
Senator Ruger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious. Let's say that I have a group of foster homes, whatever, and I'm licensed in the state of Oregon, but because of any circumstances, anything at all, my license is revoked. I'm not a good person, and so I decide I'm going to move to Montana.
You are a good person.
I am a good person. I would not do this. But I'm going to move to Montana. So Montana doesn't know that in Oregon my license is revoked. So now I am able to deal with very vulnerable people when basically I'm not a very nice person. Now, how do we justify that kind of system?
Mm-hmm. Chair Morissette and Senator Verger, one of the things that we've noticed as a department is that we are increasingly getting requests from other states who are licensing entities that operate in Oregon, and they're asking for compliance information on those entities. So typically I will get one or two letters per month from another state saying, this corporation has applied for a license in our state. Can you tell us what their history is in operating in your state? This particular bill doesn't specifically address it, but we could assume that it would also give the department the authority to look at other states where this entity might be operating to ask for compliance information there.
Follow up.
Yes.
So the responsibility then lies with those that are going to issue the license. And would you say at the present time, if we're going to issue a license and the person has been in Oregon a year, that we would perhaps check with the other states? Do we do that now?
Chair Morissette and Senator Verger, yes, we do that now. When we know that an operator is operating in other states, we will contact the other state and find out what their history has been.
So the only way that the operator really could get by with it is not to tell you that they've operated in other states?
Chair Morissette and Senator Verger, certainly they could not tell us, although often with corporations it's fairly easy for us to track down that they operate in other states by using the web.
Thank you.
Good, thanks. Okay, good question.
Yes. Thank you.
You've been waiting patiently.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Carlson, president of the Oregon Healthcare Association. We have no objections to what I think Mr. Jundeff indicated the target was of the legislation, which was to try to address some specific problems in the DD, mental health, and I know also the definition gets into potentially some residential A&D facilities. I think we've got some very different situations and different rules and regs in place for different categories of residential facilities. And when you actually pull up this statute, it's an interesting statute. When you look at 443-400, you've got sub 5 is a residential care facility, which primarily encompasses what we call residential care facilities and assisted living facilities for senior and people with disabilities, physical disabilities. You then have sub 6 is a residential facility, which is a broader definition that's encompassing also of sub 5. We've got, for instance, in RCF and assisted living rules and regulations, we've got a whole set of extensive rules and regulations that address those specific settings that don't address into the DD world, that don't address into the mental health world. Or, excuse me, had that little thing that's been going around. But a whole lot of rules and regs that aren't even addressed in those other settings. And so it's it's a little bit confusing when you actually go into the statute to see how encompassing residential facilities is when you then get into the different subcategories on rules and regs that apply in some areas and that don't apply in others. When you get into for residential care facilities and assisted living facilities, we're probably about 70% of the market is operated by organizations that have multiple facility locations throughout the state. Many of these organizations might also have, in many cases, operate licenses to operate hospitals, home health, hospice, skilled nursing. The list kind of goes on and on. And so it's very interesting when you read the statute. They actually have a specific section in the statute where they specify that they want individual licenses and that a license to operate a nursing home or a hospital or something else isn't going to, you can't operate these services under that same license. So it's very obvious that the legislature at the time and the agency at the time these rules and regs were set up made some very specific choices about wanting to license individual facilities in these cases as opposed to a global license, I guess, for an organization would be a, you know, a better way to term that. And I've got some concerns that, as I think Mary indicated, oftentimes, and I'll see this very frequently, we may have an organization operating 12 facilities. They may do an excellent job at 11 out of those 12 facilities, and they may have an issue where they've had some just particular things that are unique to that one facility. Even though I don't think in practice you would be talking about using this in such a fashion, under this law, under this bill, you would be granting broad authority where you could come in and do a license revocation in all of those facilities, even when you have no problem. In practice, what I've seen over the years is when a particular organization has troubles, this is speaking just strictly to the senior and physical disability system, not to anything that I think Mr. Jundeff was discussing in DD or mental health. But if you've got a situation with a particular organization that's troubled in multiple locations, the state has a very quick come-to-mother discussion with them. A lot of times there's a lot of focused monitoring. There's a lot of activities that go on. Sometimes there's even suggestions or requirements that folks are bringing in additional nurse consultants, bringing in additional resources that are being deployed to try to address these situations. They do a very good job at the Senior and People with Disabilities Agency on staying on top of what I would call these emerging situations. I can count on one hand probably the number of times where I've seen something that maybe got out there a little too far before it was taken care of through the years. And so, you know, I think that we've got to be very careful on how broad we would go. And I think you would have to look also very carefully at, you know, due process issues. If you've got a licensed entity that's doing an excellent job, they could have a deficiency-free survey, they could have excellent outcomes, but they may be caught up in an organization that has another troubled facility. And that's not to say that I don't want SPD to be working and maybe riding that one particular organization hard if there are issues there. I think that's appropriate. I think if we want to look at a most recent example, one that's been in the press in the assisted living sector on the situation with Sunwest Assisted Living, SPD engaged very early, very aggressively in that situation. Our organization was working very closely. They engaged at the highest level of that organization. They're has been and is enhanced monitoring, communication. SPD did an excellent job of getting out ahead of the curve there, trying to anticipate potential issues and problems that may develop, that had developed or may develop. And so I think under their current existing regulatory authority, they've got a lot of tools in the toolbox to intervene and address these kinds of situations. Has they developed, or in the example I just cited there, in many circumstances before they had a chance to develop? So I've got some concerns about the inclusion of the seniors and people with physical disabilities, RCF and ALF facilities in this. And, you know, I think if the bill is going to be moving forward, we would like to try to seek some additional clarification because we don't have one-size-fits-all licensing and regulation of residential facilities. Some are much more regulated than others.
Bob, what's the origin of this bill?
Mr. Chair, As you know...
Identify yourself again.
Sorry?
Identify yourself one more time.
Again, I'm Bob Jensen. I'm the director of Disability Rights Oregon. As you know, there's hundreds of licensed facilities across the state that house our most vulnerable people. These are people who cannot live elsewhere in the community. They need the assistance of others in order to get through day-to-day. And we depend upon the people who run these organizations to provide those folks not only with care, but...
Well, do you have a specific example of...
I'm getting. What I'm trying to paint to you, Mr. Chair, is that from our perspective as advocates, we're not talking about businesses. What we're talking about is people's lives and people's safety. And at the very minimum, we believe that it's the state and government's obligation to assure that when it provides a license to an operator to operate a facility for this group of people, that it's going to make sure that those folks are safe. Particularly, and over the years, we've seen many instances of this, but particularly in the developmental disabilities area, we've seen situations in which residents have not been kept safe, where they've suffered grievous injuries, and the response of county government and the state at times has, let me put it to you this way, is that in these worlds, there aren't a surplus of providers, and it's very important for government to work with those providers to make sure that they correct the problems in the facilities in order to make sure that folks are safe. But what we see is that sometimes, even though on the street among agency people, they've identified providers who are just not doing a good job, the only authority that they have is to address the one problem in the one home where the problems have occurred. And the reasons that are given for that are really resource-oriented, that the agency whose job it is to assure that the folks in that licensed facility are safe just don't have the resources to go out and go to all the other places and look for the problems. By suggesting this bill to you, what we're saying is that we think that the state agency should have the authority in the appropriate cases to do that. Our experience is that, frankly, the DHS does not abuse its licensing authority. We've never seen instances of that. We haven't seen DHS bullying providers, trying to drive providers out of the state. In fact, just the opposite. I think our experience is that they work with providers to try to make sure that facilities are safe. And what we want, particularly when resources are limited and they're becoming more limited, to provide this sort of protection, that DHS has more flexibility to make sure that the folks who are living in the facilities operated by operators who have demonstrated that they don't follow the rules and they're putting people at serious risk of harm, that they have broader authority to look at multiple facilities. And that's the purpose of our bill, is to keep people safe.
Okay. Thank you. Mary, do you have the authority right now to look at the... Okay, let's say that you get a complaint about a particular facility that's owned by a particular operator that has several of them. You go to that facility and you find some deficiencies. Let's say that you get a complaint about an additional facility operated by that same owner, and you check that out. Do you have then the opportunity, the authority, to go to the owner of all of the facilities and find out from them what's going on?
Chair Morris, yes, we do. And that's often the case where if we see that a particular licensee or provider has a number of complaints in numerous organizations or facilities that are licensed, we will ask them to come in and chat with us about what we're seeing, what their plan is to address those issues. My understanding of the intent of this bill would be a situation where, let's say we have a DD provider, for example, who runs three group homes, and we know that there are serious concerns in one of the group homes, and we're looking at revoking the license. When we call the agency in for a discussion, it's often the case that the policies and practices are the same across all three group homes because the same agency runs all of them. Employees may be shared across those. A real common situation is where there haven't been appropriate background checks done and staff are shared across all three group homes. In that kind of a situation, our current authority would say that we would have to go in and revoke the license on the one facility. Unless we had concerns enough and complaints enough in the other two facilities to be able to revoke those individual licenses, we would not be able to take licensing action.
Follow up?
Yes.
Even though it's maybe one individual, gross negligence in one facility, and he also or she worked in the other two facilities where the complaints didn't come up just because of circumstances, you could get rid of the person in the one facility or they would address that, but that person could continue working in the other two facilities if they happen to be an employee?
Chair Morrison and Senator Mona Sanderson, if I may just clarify, we're talking about a situation where the licensee is the same across all three facilities. If there is an employee who is found to have committed abuse or neglect, then that particular employee would be addressed as a personnel issue. And oftentimes how that's addressed is for that employee to be let go so they don't work in multiple homes. But we're talking about an agency or a licensee that owns and operates three homes. Only one of them is showing significant problems, but we just haven't seen evidence of problems in the other two that would warrant any kind of license action.
Okay.
Did that address your question?
If there's a problem in one agency or one facility, then, okay, I understand what you're saying, and I guess I'm wondering if the scope of the bill needs to be narrowed, or because you don't want to necessarily punish the entire group. You're going to check them out individually if there's a problem, right? If you are aware of a problem, you will check each one where you find a problem. Is that correct?
Chair Morissette, that's exactly correct.
Okay.
And Mr.
Senator Cruz and then Senator Martin.
Yeah, I mean, if this is a resource issue, I guess I'm having trouble understanding how this solves anything. You have this provider that has three homes, and you have complaints on one with this bill. So at this point, then you can assume if it's bad here, it must be bad there. You're still going to have to do the investigation. So, I mean, I'm assuming we're not trying to set up a scenario where you're guilty and then you have to prove yourself to be innocent sort of thing is what I'm... the ability to say, okay, we're going to revoke the license in all these homes, no matter how many they are, aren't you still going to have to go in and have a finding of fact to be able to do that? Or, I mean, it seems to me that it's a little bit heavy-handed to say, we found valid complaints in this home, so we're going to revoke all the licenses from this corporation simply on the finding of fact in one home. And which seems to me that maybe where we're going here without doing the due diligence of going in and finding the fact in those other homes. And, because currently you can do it one by one. Now, if what we're wanting to do is somehow allow you the ability to do investigation that's not complaint-driven, you can do that already. So I understand the issue, but it's still a resource issue, I think, and I'm not quite sure I understand how this is creating something more efficient than what we've got, because I still think I would like for the agency to go in and do the investigation home by home, and especially if we're in a universe of limited providers, I'd hate to throw good ones out with bad ones simply because we can. I'm just having trouble really understanding. I understand there's a problem. I'm having trouble understanding how this is the solution, I guess.
Senator Montesanti.
Can you explain to me how often you make inspections on facilities? Is there a requirement that they need to be seen, inspected ever so often? I'd like to know the information on that.
Chair Morissette and Senator Monis Anderson, in residential facilities, I believe all three systems, the licensure period is every 2 years, and so there's an inspection for licensure purposes every 2 years. Case managers are in the residential facilities frequently, visiting their clients, attending care planning sessions, meeting with families, those kinds of things. And then in addition to the regular inspections for licensure purposes, adult protective services would go into those facilities in response to a complaint. That was an allegation that was specifically made.
Thank you.
Okay. Bob, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to leave you with one last point.
Okay.
Is that the present statute says that prior, and this is, you'll see this in your bill on page 1, line 24, because this is existing law. It says that prior to an initial licensure of a residential care facility, the department shall consider the license applicant's history of regulatory compliance and operational experience. And so the law does make the point, I believe, right now that there are bad actors out there and that sometimes they're just going to be a person or an entity that doesn't do this job right. And really at the bottom of it, all this bill seeks to do is to give DHS the authority when they figure out that there is a bad actor out there who's operating multiple facilities to take action against the bad actor and not have to go around to the multiple facilities and pick them off one by one. My understanding is that there's full due process that attaches to that type of action as there would be to any other licensure action.
Okay. Okay, one of the problems is the fiscal. And the fiscal, if you don't use this, there won't be a fiscal. So this, I don't know how you figure the fiscal in the worst-case scenario or...
Chair Morissette, what we did is we looked at the number of license revocations that we've processed over the last 2 years in the last biennium, and simply assumed that it would be approximately that number, and then attached the cost per case, which is about $5,000 to $8,000 of Department of Justice cost per contested case.
Looked at the number over the last 2 years,
right,
and added an additional number to that?
Yes, we did. Yes, Chair Morissette, we did.
Wow. That's the worst case scenario then.
Chair Morissette, that's exactly right.
Okay. Well, we're not going to be able to do anything with this, but if you wanted to do any additional work on that, that would be fine, but we will close the public hearing right now.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 275. Okay, and we have Deanna Hartwig.
Now, there are some bad ideas. And I told them, while they don't get this, they have enough tea.
Good morning.
Morning.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I am Deanna Hartwig, Administrator of the Office of Federal Resource and Financial Eligibility, Seniors and People with Disability Division, Department of Human Services. I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 275. Senate Bill 275 allows an individual with serious mental illness who is receiving public assistance, Medicaid, and had their Medicaid suspended because they were continuously incarcerated in a public institution for 12 months, to reapply for Medicaid 90 days prior to release from that institution. The 90-day time period does not give the department adequate time to process the disability determination for these individuals, which must occur before Medicaid can be authorized. The Medicaid applications for most individuals who have a disability are processed by the Senior and People with Disabilities field offices. In collaboration with the Department of Corrections, we have processed pre-release Medicaid applications for inmates with serious mental illness for the past 2 years. To date, we have processed 148 individuals with severe mental illness who were able to get Medicaid immediately upon release from prison because of this new process. The current collaborative process between the Department of Corrections and Senior and People with Disabilities allows any inmate who meets the severe mental illness criteria to apply for Medicaid 90 to 120 days prior to their release date. We have found that many individuals who meet the severe mental illness criteria don't actually complete the Medicaid application due to their impairments, so this collaborative process has been very successful in ensuring that individuals who would be eligible for Medicaid because of their disability have that established and the medical card available to them upon release. This allows them to continue to receive their medications, receive medical services. So we request that this bill be reworded to allow any inmate, not just those who were previously determined to have a severe mental illness prior to incarceration, to apply for Medicaid prior to release. Because we need 90 to 120 days to process the disability determinations that have to occur before we can authorize Medicaid, we need the pre-release time to be revised as well. We've got some suggested wording in the testimony for your consideration. We would like to remind the committee that when people apply for medical assistance, they are subject to whatever criteria and rules that are established at that particular time. So if for some reason one of these individuals did not meet the severe mental illness criteria and be eligible as a person with a disability, their eligibility for any other program depends on the rules that are in operation at that time. This bill would not give them guaranteed access to any other type program. And I'm particularly talking about the Oregon Health Plan standard, if that gives you some perspective here. So with the changes that are noticed in the testimony, we support Senate Bill 275. Because the number of people involved is relatively small, there is no fiscal impact on the department at this time. So thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill, and I'll answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said you've processed 148. How many more are in corrections that you feel are eligible for Medicaid?
Chair Morissette, Senator Modest Anderson. In discussions with the Department of Corrections, we are anticipating perhaps another 300 individuals who meet the severe mental illness criteria. That's a pretty strict criteria. It's a criteria that is most likely going to make people eligible because of their disability. This would make them eligible for Medicaid, and it is the same criteria that Social Security Administration used to determine disability impairment as well. So processing 148 individuals during the biennium that we're in, we're anticipating maybe 200 or some next biennium. We feel we can manage that group with the staff we have.
Just follow up. But then would they automatically be able to get on to Medicaid?
Chair Morissette, Senator Modest Anderson, part of the process that we go through 90 to 120 days prior to release is to make sure that the medical evaluation information that we have is shared with our presumptive Medicaid determination unit. They're the individuals who make the disability determinations using the Social Security impairment criteria. So we know coming out that they meet the disability, they would be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan Plus program.
Yeah, Senator Virger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Without my going and looking it up, would you please tell me what the criteria is for severe mental illness?
Chair Morissette, Senator Virger, I believe I'd have to look it up myself unless my... Okay, we'd have to get that information back to you. Sorry.
It's a pretty stringent criteria.
Senator?
Yeah, Mr. You would like one amendment to the bill as it's currently drafted, is that correct?
Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, but we would like the Section 7 of the bill to say, a person with a mental illness, as defined in Section 1A, may apply for Medicaid based on a disability between 90 and 120 days prior to the expected date of the person's release.
Okay, so that's replacing the current 7.
That indicates the person had to have a severe mental illness based on a disability. Frankly, it's very difficult for either Department of Corrections or the department to know the precise reason why an individual may be receiving supplemental security income or Social Security disability income. It's based on a disability, but the precise nature of that disability isn't always available to us. So we believe that if someone presents through the Department of Corrections with the severe mental illness disability, when we check it with our presumptive disability determination unit, we know that we're going to make only those individuals who are eligible on release to get the medical card.
Okay. Yeah, Ms. Chair, I just wanted to make sure I understood what changes need to be made. I mean, quite honestly, what we're dealing with, when we dealt with this with Department of Corrections, yeah. And other venues here, but I mean, if we're assuming that they're in DOC and they're getting services, this is just to make sure that they don't drop off the table upon release, that they still have they still have access to services. This makes a lot of sense. It's worded right. So, yeah, Senator Mona Sanders.
Thank you. I know there are a number of mentally ill that get into corrections. They're on medication 2 to 3 weeks, and then they are fine, and then they are released. And I would think that there are a number of those who are mentally ill that do not stay in the system long enough, not even for the 90 days. What happens to those then? They're lost, right?
Chair Morissette, Ms. Modis Anderson. Medicaid typically is terminated 30 days after someone's been
30
incarcerated.
Days after.
So, I mean, if you're in an institution for 30 days, we're going to terminate your Medicaid. If some of you recall Senate Bill 913, what it attempted to do last session was allow these individuals who were incarcerated between 31 and 365 days to have their Medicaid suspended at the local Senior People with Disabilities office rather than have the case closed. So if the case is suspended and they come out in less than 12 months and go to the local office, we can reactivate their Medicaid without them going through another application process. So this is designed more for the individuals with the longer term,
gotcha,
up to 12 months stays.
Okay. Thank you. And again, you feel you can handle this within the department without an additional...
Senator Morissette, based on the information that we have from Department of Corrections today, we believe we can handle it with the staff that we have.
Okay. Okay. Mr. Chair, let's get the amendment.
Well, we'll have to get the fiscal.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Or the statement that there is no fiscal.
Correct.
Okay, good. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 275, and going to open an informational hearing. John Mellon, would you please come up here and take a chair, because you have not had an opportunity to testify. Meredith and Mary Gear. Okay, I believe it was the first hearing we had. We had a discussion, which we didn't have an opportunity to finish. This is a follow-up meeting on the status of assisted living facilities in terms of the crisis, I guess, that we're in. And the crisis being a credit crisis that was partially responsible for the disruption of services in some areas, and one of the concerns is our patients being displaced, our patients being affected by
money being moved from one facility to another, perhaps, or any other problem. So that's pretty general. You want to start with any other problem? Go ahead, Mary.
Chair Morris.
Tell us how good things are in the industry.
Thank you for acknowledging that that was pretty general, Chair Morris. there have been the situation with SunWest, which has been very public, has certainly given us the opportunity to learn a number of lessons, and I appreciate Mr. Carlson.
Identify yourself again.
Excuse me. For the record, I'm Mary Gear. I'm the Administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care in Seniors and People with Disabilities Division, Oregon Department of Human Services. SunWest has given us the opportunity to learn a number of things, and I appreciate Mr. Carlson's earlier comments about early intervention by the department. We did intervene as quickly as possible and began intensive monitoring of all 57 at the time SunWest facilities. We identified where they were geographically. We identified local resources. We identified how many people we were looking at, and pretty quickly determined that the possibility of relocating 3,000 people simply wasn't doable. And so looked at plans for ensuring quality of care, and also began weekly for a while and then every other week conversations with SunWest, a corporate office, clinical as well as business folks, to talk about what was happening and what their plans were and how they planned to proceed. Since then, we've gone through a number of court hearings, bankruptcy hearings, sales of facilities, receiverships, foreclosure notices, those kinds of things, and as I say, have developed some protocols and lessons learned about how to address these kinds of things in the future. If there are some specific things you'd like me to talk about regarding SunWest or other situations.
Well, have there been displacements, first of all? And if so, how many? And if so, have they... we found a place for people.
Chair Morris, that there have been no facilities closed in Oregon. There have been facilities closed in other states. SunWest is a national organization operated in 36 states. There have been a number of sales. Offhand, I would say probably 18 or 19 Oregon facilities have sold. And we have done our due diligence in looking at the new licensees to ensure that they have long-term care experience, they have a good compliance history, those kinds of things, that there's been an orderly transition of ownership so that care has continued. I would say that we do know anecdotally that just based on the number of calls that we get in my office, there are a number of families who have been alarmed and concerned about the media coverage, may have moved their loved ones at their own request because of concern about corporate funding and those kinds of things, but there has not been any revocation of licenses or any time that SunWest has not been able to provide care and disrupted an entire facility full of people and needed relocation.
Okay. Senator Montesano.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How are we able to find out if I believe there is a facility in my district that the majority of the people are deaf, and I think that SunWest owned that. How can I find out what has happened to that facility? If I wanted to go online and say I have somebody in a facility, a SunWest facility, how can I find out where they are? Are they, if they're still with SunWest, if they've been sold, if they've been that type of thing?
Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Sanderson, just to answer your question, that facility is still owned and operated by SunWest. In order to be able to find that out, SunWest and most providers like them will list the facilities that they operate on their website. And so you could look up SunWest and see if that particular facility is listed. You could contact my office to ask who the owner-operator is. So those would be a couple ways to be able to find out. Thank you.
Okay, you may owner operator. What? And we'll ask Jim Carlson in just a moment. But the owner operator, these are. You want to come up, Jim?
Would you like my seat?
Thanks, Meredith.
Okay, thank you, Meredith. Are the facilities managed? Are they franchised and owned?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Carlson, President of the Oregon Healthcare Association. You have a licensee who's the licensed entity. Sometimes the ownership structure on that can be pretty diverse. I mean, just in my membership right now today, we've got counties that own facilities. We have health districts that own facilities. We have for-profit corporations that own facilities. We have nonprofit corporations that own facilities in Oregon. We have individuals that own and operate facilities. We have large health systems. So you could have Samaritan Health Services, Providence Health System. We have two Indian tribes that own and operate facilities in Oregon. And you have the state of Oregon that owns and operates. It's a nursing home.
Okay.
So you've got a diversity of entities that are licensed to operate those facilities. Sometimes the owner will have a management company.
What about Sun? I'm sorry, SunWest is what we're talking about right now.
Mr. Chair, specifically to that particular structure, which is probably about the most complicated beast you'll ever see around these parts, what you've got is generally collections of individuals that own the real estate on each of those properties. You then have the management company that operates each of those facilities. Mm-hmm. So you have one management company. Now you've got different, particularly on, these are generally speaking, pick a number, $8 to $20 million projects or properties to build and develop. They're very expensive on what we'll talk about, just the physical plant, the real estate, the location, and the like. And so generally you've got a lot of expense on that piece. You generally have a pretty good debt structure on that piece. And then you've got, in terms of that facility has to operate, if they're going to operate from a financial standpoint to be successful and operate in the black, they've got to be able to meet their operational expenses, and they've got to be able to meet that debt load.
Okay. Are the... There is a corporate organization.
Mr. Chair, yes?
That... is broken down into the different categories depending upon the site. Does the corporate organization have control over the financial aspects of each individual site?
Mr. Chair, you've got the, in this particular example we're talking about, you would have the ownership of the, you know, the physical plant and the asset that is generally a contracted management with a management company. Okay, so they're generally contracting on that with the manager who is operating that facility. Sometimes those are leases, sometimes they're management agreements. Sometimes that's the same person who owns the facility, sometimes it's not.
And I guess what I'm trying to get at is the autonomy of the individual site.
Mr. Chair, it depends. It really depends on which particular situation you're looking at. You know, if you're trying to look at financials, each of those is being run as a separate entity. Okay. Now, that management company, generally speaking, some of the advantages of having a multi-facility system in place is so on purchasing and contracting and a whole host of services, education, staff development, training, a whole host of things. There's some real economies of scale and some potential advantages that can be in place if done properly. You can have, for instance, corporate compliance nurses. You can have people who are helping you, you know, with everything from payroll to human resources to dietary staff. There's a lot of times where that kind of structure can be very conducive to actually having a better, well-run, more financially viable entity. Now, it doesn't always work. You know, you're talking about out there, you know, success and failure in a marketplace also, and some locations are better than others.
Well,
payer mix of some facilities is dramatically different from one to the next.
Yeah, there was an article about a location on our site where the manager of the site mentioned the words robbing Peter to pay Paul, mm-hmm. and kind of complaining about the fact that that site was financially viable, but there was money that left that particular site to go into what I assume was a corporate.
Mr. Chair, it kind of reminds me of the DHS rebalance process where SPD's in on budget every emergency board, yet we're a donor agency to the rest of the department. I'm sorry for that comment, but I don't think it's unusual in almost any business structure where, looking at completely different industries, if I'm someone who operates 12 McDonald's, franchises, I might have X number of those that are profitable and X that are not. Coming back into the long-term care arena, it is not unusual in the nursing facility sector to have a facility that's losing money as part of the same organization where they've got some other facilities that generate enough revenue to help, support the operation of the one that is losing money. When you get into as complex a business structure as we're going to see, and this is all ultimately going to be dealt with in the courts and everything else, bankruptcy courts and proceedings and everything on the business financial side of that, I can only trust that you've got the courts and the appropriate, folks looking at all that and trying to determine if has money, moved from one business entity to another, if everything was done appropriately and properly and I's were dotted and T's were crossed. But I think you're in a situation where we experienced a national, if not international, banking crisis. You saw a situation where lenders who had loans out to this particular organization, sometimes maybe under normal conditions, might be willing to give somebody forbearance for a while they're trying to work through some things, or folks might go out and do a refinance and bring in a new loan and restructure debt, and all the kind of common tools that would be used in that type of a situation were no longer available due to the financial crisis. This is a financial crisis that's hit every sector of our economy, and the senior housing sector was not immune from it, as the largest provider of those services in this region and one of the largest in the country, they got hit and got hit hard. How much of that was poor business decisions made along the way versus the conditions of the economy, I cannot say. That's way above my pay grade. What I can say, and what I do have direct knowledge of, is that the state of Oregon, specifically the Senior and People with Disabilities Division, engaged early. They engaged aggressively. They engaged on all fronts. James Taves and I were on the phone with each other many an evening and over weekends. The top management and clinical staff and others at SunWest was engaged early. They started sharing financial information. They started sharing all kinds of information that actually their attorneys and their lenders and everyone else were advising them not to share, things far beyond what they were required to share or engage with the state on under law was being shared initially at weekly meetings, and then I think they've gone to twice a month meetings. And so you got a lot of folks over there still with their nose to the grindstone, working hard. The top priority at all times was to try to make sure that the care and the services being provided to the residents was the first priority. And quite frankly, when you make a tough business decision, which is I'm not going to pay the mortgage this month, I'm not going to pay the bank, I'm not going to pay the lender, because we've got to make sure the resources are going into the services, it doesn't work out well on the business side, where foreclosures and receiverships are usually the legal action taken by that lender when someone's missing mortgage payments. But I think all efforts were made to try to keep the residents at the forefront, based on my own personal observations.
Okay, thank you. I remember a conversation that we had a couple of years ago. We had the nursing home manager of the Marquee in Springfield at our committee, and they took over McKinsey Manor and upgraded it significantly. But he was complaining bitterly about the lack of reimbursement from the state. And so out in the hall, I said, "Why did you buy that place then?" And he said, "Well, I don't know, but I'm subsidizing it with my operation in Idaho." So so I guess that that's then somewhat common. I mean, you...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I mean, folks, it has been my experience in healthcare broadly and in long-term care and senior housing specifically, most of the people, the vast majority of the people who are working in these fields are in it for all the right reasons and are very committed people. Now, from a business standpoint, business people have to make sure that they're making smart business decisions also. But I think we're, for the most part, very blessed in this particular state to have a lot of really good, caring, committed, hardworking, upfront folks who do an excellent job. It doesn't mean that we don't have situations that develop where you've got folks who are bad, bad managers, bad caregivers, bad operators, and those are not the people we want delivering services to vulnerable Oregonians. We want to make sure we're not papering over bad care, justifying bad care, or doing anything we can to protect and shelter those folks. And my experience has been we do a pretty good job of that here in Oregon. It's not to say that sometimes bad things don't happen, that you won't have business failures, that you won't have a situation where the wrong person gets hired who does the wrong thing to people, that people won't be hurt or harmed sometimes. We've got humans involved in doing all this, and so you got the human element involved, and sometimes humans make mistakes, sometimes they make errors, and sometimes we've got folks who just ought not be involved in any way, shape, or form in healthcare or caregiving professions.
Thank you. John Mullen, would you contribute to this conversation, please?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I want to take just a minute for some background very quickly because I think it sheds some light on this discussion. As some members of the committee know, I was the director of Clackamas County Social Services for many years through 2006. When we first started out in 1982, as the waivers were hitting the state of Oregon, our Medicaid nursing home count in Clackamas County was 803 about 26 years ago in February of 1982. When I left the organization, the Medicaid nursing home count was around 350. And the reason for that decline was not that we cut services for people, obviously, is that we greatly invested in the community-based care system. The reason I bring that up is when we first started assisted living was not on the radar screen, but adult foster homes became a means of helping people to live on their own. There were absolutely no rules at the state level. The first rules really came from Multnomah County and Clackamas County passing ordinances because we recognized there needed to be some issues around care and quality concerns that had some enforcement aspect to it. When assisted living facilities became the new approach to providing community-based long-term care, a new option, there was a very much a concerted effort at the state level to make regulations almost non-existent to encourage the industry to flourish. At one point in time, I said, I think we're going to have an assisted living facility on every street corner in Clackamas County because we went from zero to about 15 or 16 in a very short period of time. The reason that I say all of this is because recent issues that have arisen on the coast and throughout the state, has been talked about today, have been concerns to the Oregon Law Center and to other organizations that are concerned about consumer and client protections. We got together with Legal Aid Services, with Disability Rights Organization and Lane County Legal Aid and Advisory and Advocacy Center a while back and began some discussion with seniors and people with disabilities a little over a year ago. And those discussions have really been good discussions. One of the perspectives that we have taken as a group is to note that the whole idea about the waivers was to help people to live independent, but they really are ICF or nursing home level impairments. And so we think about that in terms of their service, but don't think about that in terms of their rights. The protections for nursing facility residents as far as transfer rules are much more stringent and are prescribed at the federal level. So what we did is we came up with a group of core principles that we talked about with the state, submitted them to SPD, and talked about the fact that there needs to be our review of a purpose statement along the lines of what exists for nursing home residents as far as their rights are concerned. That also we need to clarify voluntary transfer rights for clients as well as involuntary transfer rights. And then finally, we wanted to do what we could to emphasize the need to limit Medicaid withdrawal. Now, I put all of this in the perspective of what you all did in 2008, which was really great, passing Senate Bill 1061, as far as that bill was concerned, talked about the present conditions, but also the past, what we've accomplished in Oregon, and then where we might head in the future. And one of the crisis issues that was identified was the reimbursement rate, even though it was eventually taken out of the bill and passed separately by Ways and Means. If you think back in 2008, we were mainly talking about the issue being a reimbursement issue as far as the assisted living facilities were concerned. It turns out that the issue is really pretty a bit more complicated than just the reimbursement rate from the state level. So the only thing that I would say in speaking before you today is that we're committed to engage with the state. These are not easy situations to work our way through, but we really are looking at this again from a consumer client perspective. The promise of the system when we started way back in 1982 when we had community-based care was that people were going to be able to age in place. And maybe at times we were a bit more ideological about it than was practical. But in fact, when you think about people that are being displaced from a place that they call home, we should tread very lightly on that and make sure that we have protections there for consumers. Thank you.
Okay. that's what we're trying to evaluate, I guess, is do we have adequate protections for seniors? Have we had displacements? If so, what are we doing about it? Now, Mary, one more time, have people been displaced from these facilities? And if so, have we found areas for them to go, Medicaid people?
Chair Morissette, as a result of the financial difficulties with SunWest, there have not been residents displaced at all. I would say that there have been a number of gradual withdrawal contracts in assisted living facilities. We've presented on those before.
Okay.
And there is a corporation in Oregon that's been very clear about not serving Medicaid as a part of their corporate mission. And so there have been and there will be Medicaid residents who will potentially be displaced as a result of those gradual withdrawal contracts and potential termination of contracts over time.
Yes.
For the record, Jim Carlson, to that point, both the agency and us with that particular organization that Mary just referenced, which was the one that actually pulled out of the Medicaid program on the facility on the coast, both the agency and our organization tried to intercede with that organization and urge them to do what's called a gradual Medicaid withdrawal contract, which means anyone that you admitted at the time you had a Medicaid contract and disclosed that you had a Medicaid contract, you would care for and continue to provide services for that individual for the duration of their service needs. Unfortunately, that was an organization that's not a member of our organization. They did not heed any of the warnings or discussions that came from the state or from us, and they made that decision, and they created a very bad situation where folks were dislocated. With that said, in my experience, I believe that's our only immediate Medicaid contract withdrawal that I recall at any time in Oregon since 1997. There was others at various points who had considered that course action who have been persuaded to move to a gradual withdrawal. And I can tell you, as just a standard policy, anytime any of our members ever makes contact with anyone on our staff and has a discussion about, now what's it take to pull out of the Medicaid program, we will urge in the strongest terms possible to anyone that we work with to do a gradual withdrawal, not to do an immediate withdrawal. And in my memory, we've had one circumstance where one facility actually executed an immediate withdrawal contract, and that was the one in Representative Cowan's district.
And mine.
And Senator Verger, excuse me.
When a person goes in and as a client, private pay client, and they then spend down and become Medicaid, does that impact how many people I guess one of the complicating factors, you know, we've had this discussion about, you know, how many Medicaid people are you willing to take? Well, do they know when people are going to spend down and become Medicaid clients? Because that complicates their load. If they say, well, we will take 5%, and then suddenly people spend down, they have 10%, 15%.
Sure, Mr. Chair. You know, what you're describing is, you know, one of those challenges. You know, folks come up and you've got your model on, you know, what revenues you need to meet your expenses and to pay your bills and the like. And those are based generally on some assumptions around payer mix and what your revenues are for each of those facilities. And the way it's currently structured, you've got a Medicaid contract or you don't have a Medicaid contract. You've got upfront regulations that are there around consumer disclosure. And so you're disclosing prior to admission to that individual, yes, we have a Medicaid contract. No, we don't have a Medicaid contract. Here's what our scope of services are that we can provide. If you need services at this level, that's beyond our ability to provide those services in this setting. And so you need to have a good upfront level of understanding on all of those things. So when people are coming in, and the vast majority of folks coming into the setting are admitted private pay, at some point, and it could be, you know, 1 to 3 months, or it could be 1 to 6 years, or it could be never, if somebody needs Medicaid to step in, has that safety net, very difficult for a provider to predict that or to, you know, be able to project that with any degree of accuracy. And so it's a real challenge. Some states have permitted contracting where we will contract for 10 Medicaid slots or we'll contract for 5 Medicaid slots, some different things. That's not been the model that's used here. It's an option that's been discussed and has been looked at potentially as a way to try to attract some facilities that currently don't contract with Medicaid to come into the Medicaid program, but that's not an option at this point.
Okay. So a company that will contract for 10 Medicaid clients, if they get them through spending down, then they close their door to other Medicaid clients.
Well, Mr. Chair, generally speaking right now, no, that hasn't been the case. What you started to see, and that became really almost almost a crisis level over about the last 3 or 4 years, is we had not done a very good job of continuing to put money into our community-based care system.
Right.
And we got to a point where our Medicaid reimbursement rates were, depending on which piece of the pie we're looking at, what service area, I mean, we were probably approaching 50 cents, 60 cents on the dollar of where private pay rates were. And so the $280 per month, the $260 plus the COLA July 1, has probably gotten us up into an 85% of market, somewhere in that neighborhood, which has made a significant difference. One area in particular we had some real problems were for Alzheimer's care and Alzheimer's care units, where we were able to make that adjustment October 1 also. And so I think that has really helped address it. Part of the problem we're now once again in this cycle that we find ourselves in the state. On the revenue side, there are no COLAs in the governor's recommended budget. We're into some just horrendous and huge cuts on eligibility and reimbursements and everything once again being proposed in the governor's budget. And so if you step back and look at from a provider standpoint on contracting with the state of Oregon as your partner to provide services to people who have needs, the state of Oregon at times has been a pretty good partner, at other times a pretty unreliable partner to do business with. I don't think we're seeing a lot of withdrawals at the present time. I think we've kind of stemmed the tide, and I think we've stabilized the market out there considerably. But, you know, I can't predict what it's going to look like again in another 18 months or 24 months. And, and we're just going to have to look. One thing I can say is the slowdown in the housing market will probably result in some pretty flat or even diminished caseload growth in the RCF, assisted living, Medicaid sector, because a lot of people who enter those settings generally do so with resources that come from the sale of their home. And so just the challenges or inability of folks to sell their homes right now who are out there, even though they may have some increasing needs and they may be, you know, looking to or desiring to move into a supportive living environment, I think that's slowed down significantly. And so, you know, we're going to see an interesting situation depending on how long this economic crisis lasts and the housing market lasts on what's happening out in the sector, because it is somewhat sensitive to some of those changes in the housing market.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Yeah, Senator Fridger.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to compliment Jim Carlson on his common sense presentation today and giving credit to the good people that are there really working very hard in the state of Oregon. But, Jim, I have a question for you, and that is that when the bankers received money that they could loan and decided to buy Treasury bonds instead, That should give you pause as to just exactly when they're going to really free up money. And from the business side, do you see many facilities that are going to be caught in that cycle of not being able to borrow and not be able to pay off the mortgage loan? That will change considerably in the next 6 months.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, first of all, thank you very much for your kind comments to your question. Yeah, what happens in the capital markets, what happens specifically in the banking sector, has a huge impact in the senior housing side of things, and as it does in most business sectors. Right now, there just flat out has been no availability of any capital for, you know, remodels, refinances, or new construction at all anywhere in the sector. I mean, that money just went away. As we start to see, hopefully, you know, that sector turning the corner, and you start to see banks and lenders and others loaning money again, you know, you hope to see that come back. Specifically, you know, we're all aware of the SunWest financial troubles. There has been one other facility that filed for bankruptcy that I'm aware of to date in Oregon. It was about 2 weeks ago, and it was not because the facility was actually operating in the red. It was a situation where the bank was maybe engaging in a little bit aggressive or even predatory kind of practices where they were trying to foreclose on them due to a violation of a loan covenant, even though they were continuing to make their payments. And so the facility filed bankruptcy basically to protect themselves as a defensive measure, if you will, against mm-hmm. a foreclosure action. Mm-hmm. And actually, a lot of what you saw in the whole SunWest situation was really a big high-stakes chess game between the banks and the lenders and SunWest and some of their investors on basically trying to head off foreclosure actions. So, you know, in some of these situations, even if the facility is making their debt service payments, the bank may have, due to losses they're experiencing in other, you know, aspects of their portfolio and everything else, they may be looking to eliminate risk in their portfolio. They may be taking whatever actions they're taking for their own proprietary business reasons.
Mr. Chair, yes. You're seeing that in the private market as well, where people have the credit rating that would actually, in normal times, provide them with a loan of any kind, mm-hmm. and the banks are refusing to loan, and the other financial interests are refusing to loan the money. Which is very, very different than we've ever seen before.
Absolutely.
Well, we've had a couple of mobile home manufacturers close in Lane County for that very reason. Just the credit market was not there to sustain them. It's a sustainable industry, but they...
Right.
The other thing, are you tracking the federal Medicaid reimbursement?
When the stimulus, Mr. Chair?
The stimulus, yeah.
Yes, very closely. I mean, obviously, looking at what we saw in the governor's budget, looking at what's happening on the state revenue picture, for those of us in the senior and people with disabilities advocacy world, we're tracking that very closely. I think the big question I've got right now. We know roughly what we've got in the House version. The Senate's had a bill marked up in Finance Committee, and we'll see how that goes, making its way to the Senate floor. There's a significant amount of money there for Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see Medicaid match rates in all likelihood far higher than anything I've seen in the 22 years I've been working in this policy arena. And we're probably, while we aren't going to get to quite a 70% match rate, we're going to be in the very high 60s on our match rate. And it's a very significant stimulus, actually, to the state's economy. This is a very large employment sector. I mean, if you looked at just the lost jobs from the lost federal funds and the governor's recommended cuts to the senior and people with disabilities program, it's about 11,000 jobs we would lose if we actually made those cuts just off the federal funds piece alone, not even looking at the state funds piece. So it's huge. So I think the big question I've got on, will it be enough to do most of what we need to do next biennium? I think the answer is it's not going to be enough to do everything we need to do. And the big question is, how much money are we going to need to take to close out the 07-09 biennium? It's retro in the House bill and in the Senate bill to October 1 of 2008. And so we're going to pick up an enhanced match for a big chunk of this biennium. And the question is, how much of that money will the legislature take to close out this biennium? And will they rob Peter to pay Paul? Will they grab Medicaid dollars from that retro portion and to shelter other programs and service areas from cuts, mm-hmm. and take those cuts at the expense of these particular programs? So that whole rob Peter to pay Paul game, it might happen in the business world, but it certainly happens in the government and even in occasion at the legislature.
Often. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Thank you for that opportunity to editorialize a little.
That's fine. Good. Okay, thank you very much. Meredith, would you come up and give us a kind of a update on what's going on from your perspective? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Meredith Cote, and I'm the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman. And what I was asked to do today was to bring you the sort of finalized data that I presented to you when I was here last. As you recall, I had indicated that we were just finalizing some of our program data for the past fiscal year. So I wanted you to have it in writing and finalized. The only thing that I was thinking about relative to our conversation last time was about, as you recall, billing issues were very prominent in that discussion. And I had an occasion to look at the disclosure statement that we require of assisted living facilities, I recognize that in that disclosure statement, we really don't ask anything to be disclosed about billing. How often cost of living increases occur in the facility. In other words, how often they would assess a general across the board cost of living. There's no required disclosure of what kind of payment system they use to assess services. So one of the issues around billing is there's a lot of confusion among consumers when they get their bills. And I didn't know if Senator Montes Anderson was continuing to be concerned about that, but I do think that at least in part, we could address some of the issues by having more disclosure relative to what the practices are of the facility relative to, like I said, either across the board or how they assess services and how they charge for those services.
Okay, the complaint dated October 1st, 07 to September 30th, 09. Could you just kind of explain that?
Well, Mr. Chair, what the Ombudsman Program does is basically when we get a complaint and we work it to completion or resolution.
Yeah.
And so closing a case means that the case is completed, okay. All activity of the program relative to that complaint.
I see.
For the time being, it has ended, is closed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, based on some of the discussion that we've had today, what's your feeling about where we are in terms of adequate care given in these difficult times and with the change in... Now, I know you spent 80 hours, or your people did, at the SunWest and so on. So you've been involved with closures or potential closures and cutbacks and what some people complain about, denial of services in terms of food, cleanliness, and so on and so forth. Now, this is, you know, you've talked about that earlier, but I guess we're all concerned about the ongoing situation. Now, mm-hmm. You're approaching it from a different aspect than other people who are here that we're reporting, because you deal with the complaints, and you give it, you know, that, so that's a different perspective. This is interesting data, but just mm-hmm. anecdotally and so on, how are things going?
Well, Mr. Chair, as I indicated to the committee last time I was here, I was appointed by the bankruptcy court out of Tennessee to monitor one of the SunWest facilities in Springfield during the pendency of the bankruptcy. And so that part of what the law requires is that we interview what the law calls the patients, the residents of the facility, and that we because the law and the reason why we're placed in the facility is that it's for consumer protection. It's to ensure that the residents are being well served while the facility is in bankruptcy and may be having other financial priorities or whatever. In the particular facility that we're in, what my experience has been is that we have not had big or quality of care issues, that is, systemic resident care issues. What we've had in the facility, and it sort of is what I have seen has been a problem that we have seen throughout this particular chain, and in this particular facility, it's personified. Our issues around food service, significant issues around food service, and when we go in and we look at this problem, there's a high level of dissatisfaction among the residents, and in fact, the case manager who goes in twice a month in the last 60-day period told us that she is fielding, was fielding almost daily complaints about the food, and that's and that's a perennial issue that we have had with this chain in these facilities. Is that there seems to be a lack of a commitment to dining services, and we find is there whether those issues go to the people that are brought in to provide the service, the quality of the product that's provided, but this particular situation we found in ourselves in personified what we have had as an ongoing concern with this particular chain. Another thing that happened in this, unfortunately, with this particular facility, and this preceded the bankruptcy, is that there were a number of thefts within the facility, and to cause a lot of concern and police involvement and ultimately Adult Protective Services involvement. And that has been a concern. One of the things that we have found throughout this process is that, and I don't know whether it's attributable to the bankruptcy or just the facility's policy, is that it has been very difficult to get residents reimbursed for their losses. And we have also had some situations where people have been due reimbursements for other things when they leave the facilities, and those have been difficult as well. So I don't know whether that's attendant to the bankruptcy or just the facilities policy, but I know that right now we're working on trying to get reimbursed some residents that sustained one a $2,700 loss of cash and another a personal item, and the thefts occurred in October, and we have not been yet able to get reimbursement for those thefts. And so those are the kinds of things. It seems like some of the responses get slowed in this bankruptcy process, and I'm hesitant a little there because I don't know whether these are corporate decisions attendant to the bankruptcy. I just know that they're occurring. And so I get concerned about residents, when a facility is in bankruptcy, getting their appropriate reimbursements, getting for things that they are legally due. So I worry about these kinds of things because this issue has come up a couple of times.
Okay.
Well, more than a few times, I should say.
Now, the very first discussion that we had today had to do with what goes on in a particular facility and what goes on in the rest of the chain. So are you saying that, okay, now that particular facility has been sold, from what I understand?
I don't believe the one that I am currently the patient care ombudsman for has been sold.
Now, is that the one in Springfield?
Right, unless Mary knows something that I don't know.
Okay, that's the Sunwest.
Right.
Okay, in Springfield. Now, are you do you have other complaints than similar in other of their holdings around the state?
Well, there are concerns among their holding that relate to, in their holdings that relate to quality of care. There are definite facilities within there that quality of care is an issue and is a concern. And I think that the regulatory agency that we are concerned about. That doesn't happen to be the actual quality. That is the personal care that's delivered to the residents, the services that they receive attendant to their health care, those kinds of things don't seem to be significant issues in the one that I am currently appointed at. However, there are among that chain, there are facilities in which there are issues that are of concern.
Okay.
And there's one that's in your jurisdiction as well that we're concerned about right now, and there's some discussion as to whether we will become the patient care ombudsman for that facility.
Now, what about the chain of command? Who do you forward these complaints to? The DHS, SPD? Mary, would you come up again?
With respect to this particular chain, I don't think that there's hardly anything that we know that Mary doesn't know in her capacity.
Well, what are you doing? What are we doing about it, if anything? Mary, you want to introduce
Mary's
yourself again?
Mary's the big regulator. So
okay, Mary is a big...
Yeah.
Chair Morissette, for the record, I'm Mary Gear, the Administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care. When we get complaints about any facility, including Sunwest, we triage them through our protective services system, and where there is an allegation of abuse or neglect, we investigate those. In addition, we've asked our local offices to pay particular attention to any complaints in Sunwest facilities, and to, if it's not an abuse and neglect issue warranting an adult protective services response, asking perhaps a case manager to check up on food complaints are very common, and there's certainly been reporting in the media about Sunwest spending less money than average on food and those kinds of things, and that's been part of our ongoing discussions with Sunwest, is what their food service is and is expected to be. So when we talk about increased monitoring of Sunwest facilities, those are the kinds of things that we're paying attention to.
So what will ultimately, worst case scenario, you shut them down? I mean, what? How do you remedy the situation?
Chair Morissette, worst-case scenario, given egregious events that have happened in the facility, yes, we would shut them down. We have a number of tools that we use before that in order to have a facility address specific concerns. And in addition, our every other week meetings with SunWest corporate folks has been an opportunity for us to say, okay, corporate-wide, this is what we're hearing. There's food complaints in a number of your facilities. We're seeing some clinical complaints in these facilities. How are you addressing those? On an individual facility basis with a license, we can do things like require, put a condition on the license that might require the facility to have clinical consultation or administrative consultation, bring in a management consultant or a nursing consultant or a pharmacy consultant.
Are you doing those things?
Chair Morissette, yes, we are. We're doing those things in a number of facilities. And I also get a weekly report of any corrective action we've taken against SunWest facilities.
Mr. Chair, one of the things about long-term care facilities is that frequently there are issues within a facility, and they're all dealt. There could be a number of different issues going on at the same time. Some of them are dealt with by the ombudsman within the facility. When they get to a level that's either abuse or a systemic licensing problem, they'll be brought to the attention of the licensing agency or Adult Protective Services. And what happens is that the environment of every facility, there's this interaction, there are events going on, there are things that are going on that perhaps shouldn't, but what happens is that sometimes we address those issues as they come up, and sometimes successfully or not. One of the frustrations of the ombudsman, of course, is that they work to address something, but then the next week it's back to where it was. But then there are facilities in which the critical mass in terms of how many events are happening, how many adverse events are happening, is large, and it doesn't seem that it's easily resolved. And that's usually when Mary will come in bring the bigger guns in terms of a more systemic regulatory response to the issue. Some facilities that you have concerns about what's going on, and you're seeing a problem, and you just watch it, and you work to correct the immediate problem, and then you watch it to see whether that problem reemerges again. And sometimes the ombudsman is involved in that. Sometimes it's a much bigger regulatory effort to do that. But very few of these environments are without problems at some time. And I'm not saying that to excuse that, because God knows I'd like it to be the case that they were. But there's just a lot, they're very dynamic environments, and there's usually a lot going on.
Now, in the case of the $2,000+ that was missing or stolen or whatever, and other incidents, have the individuals who were the perpetrators of that been dealt with?
Hard to find them.
I believe, Mr. Chair, that is still a matter of investigation. I know that there's been a civil penalty assessed against the facility relative to that, but I don't know whether the perpetrator was ever identified.
And Chair Morissette, my understanding is that it's sitting with law enforcement. The department's piece of the regulatory picture was to look at the practices of the facility and to ask them to correct anything that might have made people more vulnerable. But the actual tracking down a perpetrator in the theft situation was immediately referred to law enforcement for follow-up.
And that was one incident of several, though, from what I understand.
Chair Morissette, that's exactly right.
And so has that been corrected in terms of the management?
Chair Morissette, actually, yes, it has. And although there have been some thefts in that particular facility since there's been a change in administration, it's certainly not to the extent it was before.
Now, is this an industry-wide Well, okay. There are things that happen across the board. I mean, on an ongoing basis. But this is this reflective of the company itself? Is it reflective of the difficult times that we're going through?
Chair Morissette, when we learned of the number of thefts of resident funds in this particular facility, we looked at the allegations of theft in other SunWest facilities and did not see a systemic problem. It appeared to us that it was pretty isolated to this particular facility.
That's kind of what I was getting at.
In that magnitude.
Okay. Good. Thank you. And then you are currently working with that facility. Is that correct?
Chair Morissette, I would need to look and see if we're in a regulatory pattern with that particular facility. I don't believe that we are. The pattern of thefts that we were seeing was last fall, September, October.
But what about the food issues and so on? I mean, it seems to me that there were some other problems that you were...
Chair Morissette, on the issue of the food, we would be asking case managers probably to look into that unless there was... an issue of someone not being fed, for example.
Okay. Well, I guess what I'm getting is a kind of a mixed thing is that, you know, things are okay in the industry, things are not okay in this area, in this particular facility, but yet things are okay in this particular facility. I don't know where you are on that, because a little while ago we were talking about calling in the big guns and that you had called in the big guns to work with the management to correct the various shortcomings.
Chair Morissette, that's exactly right. We did call in the big guns with SunWest. Where a particular facility is in terms of compliance is a fluid thing.
Yeah.
And so when we have our meetings with SunWest to talk about clinical and business issues, what we identify is the facilities where we've seen a pattern of problems. Mm-hmm. Or where we've seen an incident recently that causes us concern. And so the facility where Ms. Cody is the patient representative is not a facility where we've seen a number of systemic problems, these thefts that were quite obvious and of difficulty last fall did cause us concern. But in the continuum of SunWest facilities that we have concern about, I would say it's about in the middle.
Okay.
And if I might add, Chair Morissette, we don't have really good tools to compel a facility to provide a credible dining service to residents unless residents are experiencing weight loss and other kinds of things that would go to their health such that their health would be jeopardized. So, and that's been one of the issues with this chain and food issues, is that the quality of the food, the way the food is delivered to people, whether people are served in a timely manner, whether there are skilled people preparing the food, none of those things, are there any real regulatory tools to deal with unless it gets to the place where resident health and safety are jeopardized. So it's basically a system where we identify the problem as ombudsmen and we keep trying to problem solve in the building, trying to implore the provider to do the right thing. And so that's where we find ourselves with a lot of the food issues.
Jim, did you want to comment?
Thank you, Chair Morissette. For the record, Jim Carlson, Oregon Healthcare Association. The issue around dining and food in long-term care and senior living, if you were to look at just about any resident satisfaction survey in just about any facility in the country, food is almost always at the top of the list. And the reason, there's a lot of reasons for it. Some of them actually clinical, some of them preferential. Some of them, I mean, it may just be poor dining, poor food service, poor quality and the like. But I can tell you, with my own personal experience with my own grandmother when I was her personal representative, and she was in an assisted living facility, and I would go dine with her frequently. The food quality at that particular facility was actually excellent when I would dine with her, and I would find the meal to be a very good meal. She said, this is not like meatloaf. I like on the meatloaf, I like some, I would always make it with this, or I would do this. On other things, her taste buds, as you age, you have diminished sense of taste, and so things there. So different people, a meal, a particular preparation one person likes, that another person likes, another person likes, mm-hmm. we could have three very different opinions. If we were to go up to the dining room up there that you're going to have lunch at today with some of your colleagues, and we were going to survey all of them
The
food's terrible. But I'm just saying, this is a very complex area. There are things that the state has in the rules and in the regs around nutritional content and different things on dining that the facilities are surveyed on. The facilities who compete in a private pay marketplace, and remember, most of these residents enter the facility as private pay, not on Medicaid. Food service is a very important component of what they're looking at when they're making a determination on whether they're going to choose this facility versus this facility. So the facilities take food service and dining very seriously, but I will say it's a very difficult program area to get high ratings consistently on for most of your residents. I heard one comment earlier about the price on food in terms of the average facility spends X amount versus X amount specific to SunWest spending less amount. SunWest was buying over $25 to $30 million worth of food a year because they had 300 locations across the country. They can drive volume and price down substantially. They historically have, compared to what anyone else would pay in this market for the same product or same service. They were probably driving price down by, in some cases, maybe as much as a third or more, depending on the product category. And so you've got to be really careful on some of these comparisons about the average is X and they're spending Y, because I can't buy a pound of ground beef for the same amount McDonald's buys a pound of ground beef. McDonald's is getting a much better price on it because they buy so much.
Okay. I guess what I'm concerned about is, that particular facility, which I hear a lot about when I'm at home. I get phone calls from various people. And I'm also, and I know you're working hard on that particular facility. And the bottom line is consumer protection. And so we're going through some difficult. Now, we have a floor session that starts at 10, and so I'm going to have to move on.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
At this time, we will close the public hearing on the information and close the meeting.